Hey, it's Bantam. This week, the story picks up pace, and I'm excited to bring you 5 chapters to dive into. A quick note. The final chapter in this episode, chapter 31, contains graphic and explicit sexual content that may not be suitable for all listeners. I wanted to give you a heads up so you can navigate the episode comfortably. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. It's the best way for others to discover Rose and Jason's journey. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Share your thoughts, feedback, or suggestions on Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, Twitter X, or Mastodon. Let's connect. With that, it's time to hack destiny. Chapter 27. The Gaudy Side of Town. Easton. When Easton re-entered the reception hall after kicking Romstaller out, everyone was still laughing and chatting as if nothing had transpired. He was relieved that the disturbance had not been noticed. He joined Mac Mason, Jason Sola, and Nila Matnev, who stood in a circle talking.
"Easton!"
exclaimed Nila, placing their hand on Easton's forearm. They wore a velvet cloak jacket and black waistcoat with chalk stripes and matching black pants. Mac, who had been staring absently, seemed to perk up when Easton joined them.
"I was telling Jason about some of the first investments we got into back when the Pyramid Club was just getting up and running, like Branch and DeepCert. I told him that I like to brag about being a Pyramid Club OG,"
Nila declared, using the colloquialism meaning old gangster.
"It's true. Nyla's been a Pyramid Club member since almost the beginning. They probably referred more people than anyone,"
Easton said.
"Damn straight. All keepers, too."
"Keep them coming. You've helped the Pyramid Club family grow."
Easton turned to Jason.
"Speaking of referrals, you decided to come back. You must be enjoying yourself."
"I haven't had much to look forward to recently, except for these events."
He looked around in admiration.
"It's only my second one, and I'm starstruck. Talking with Nila Matnev now. Brax Holland is over there. It's nuts. The investment and wealth-building opportunities, too. They're amazing. But I gotta say, the best part was Compass Rose's performance."
Easton smiled.
"It certainly is a unique part of this club. Musical performances and investing."
"What was the inspiration for these bedfellows? Music and money?"
asked Nila. It had been Rose's idea to marry music and investments in the form of a DAO, but he would not tell that to the group, because Rose was his silent partner. Knowing management of such a lucrative business could make her a target, he decided to protect her by obfuscating her stake and her role in the business of the Pyramid Club.
"When members watched pitches, I felt they would be thinking quantitatively and financially, but I figured that by providing memorable entertainment, it would turn the switch in his or brain that would take them out of quantitative mode and relax them, so he or she could start thinking about the investment opportunity with a neutral mind."
Nila chimed in.
"You're onto something. I found that it helps me remember the presentations and recall them later,"
they said.
"I anchor my gut feelings about each pitch to the subsequent performances. Like, Rose sang that throwback song from the 90s after we heard about that micro-satellite company."
Suddenly, Mac interrupted.
"I almost brought my UD inside a few events ago."
The others looked at Mac, seemingly puzzled at his non sequitur.
"I'm curious. Had I brought my UD in here, what would have happened?"
"Depends,"
Easton responded.
"It wouldn't function in here."
"What about Branch? If we have Branch in our bodies, does it still collect our data while we're in here?"
Easton hesitated before answering, thinking to himself,
"Why is he asking these probing questions about club security?"
Then he responded directly to Mac.
"Branch still gathers data, but Branch and a person's UD won't connect because the UD is deactivated while on the premises."
He tried to steer the conversation away from threads that could reveal Pyramid Club's secrets.
"Bottom line, don't bring your UD to Pyramid Club events, then it won't get damaged."
"Fair enough."
"Typically, Our security system can tell when someone is going to enter with an activated UD, and we can usually intervene before our security infrastructure encrypts all its data, which renders the UD useless, practically speaking. We usually just tell people to leave it outside.
Glad I left it at home, then.
Me too,
said Easton. Neela began to speak, but before they could say anything substantive, Easton thanked the group and excused himself from their conversation. From over his shoulder, Easton heard someone calling out to him.
Excuse me.
Easton turned to see Jason, whiskey in hand.
Jason, what can I do for you?
He asked.
I don't want to hold you up, but I had a question. Eventually, I'd love to be introduced to Rose. Is that possible?
Well, she usually mingles with members after the performance. That's the best time. She's a hit. It may take a couple tries, but you will.
Thanks.
Jason nodded and smiled. His eyes seemed to brighten.
Certainly.
Easton nodded back, then turned and continued into the crowd. The cocktail hour in the reception hall was finally winding down, and the members were about to be ushered into the main hall for their dinners and investment presentations before Compass Rose performed. Momentarily, Easton forgot about Rammstahler's assault, his own impending death and abandonment of Rose, and the burden of song he would posthumously foist upon her. Chapter 28, Walk into the Light. Jason. Mingling with the world's elite, Brax Holland, Camille Sandeni, the Masons, felt strange to Jason. He had represented a few minor celebrities and some wealthy people, but never the mega rich. They were a different species of human.
It takes a certain attitude to become a trillionaire,
he thought as he shook Nadine Aden's hand.
Money must be the primary motivation, protecting it, wielding it, leveraging it over adversaries and preventing others from taking it.
His newly earned proximity to power and wealth at the Pyramid Club, while intoxicating, did not overshadow the most important aspect of the club for him.
Rose.
He had found the woman of his dreams. He had named her Rose eponymously for her tattoo when she was merely a figment, but it turned out she was real, and it was her actual name. When she performed the Pyramid Song at the first club event he attended, he had stared at the Compass Rose tattoo hovering above her cocktail dress the entire time she sang. Suddenly, he remembered Corrine and her mystic pyramid, a tarot card with a pyramid and a star above its apex with a man throwing coins in front. Now Jason was at the Pyramid Club, its insignia above its front door and on Jason's own lapel pin matching the symbols and the fortune Corrine conveyed to him.
Corrine was right. With her guidance, it was my fate to find the Pyramid Club, and to find Rose.
He was so entranced by the idea of meeting Rose that he lost track of his present conversation with Nadine Aden. She stared at him, one eyebrow raised, appearing to be waiting for an answer.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
He asked. She huffed.
I asked you how you could defend people in court if you know they're guilty. I wouldn't be able to do it.
Before Jason could answer, a tall figure with a black silk Versace suit and dark chestnut skin appeared behind Aden and put a hand on her shoulder.
Could I have a minute with Mr. Sola?
The corners of LaDonna Chambers' mouth were turned upward in a slight closed-mouthed smile.
Why does she want to talk to me?
Jason thought.
She must hate me.
Aden pivoted to look at Chambers standing behind her.
Sure, LaDonna.
She said, before glancing back at Jason and strutting away.
Hello, M. Chambers,
Jason said, extending his hand for a handshake. LaDonna just peered at Jason and clasped her hands in front of her, ignoring Jason's gesture.
So you know who I am?
It was not a question. He dropped his hand when he realized she was snubbing him.
What's this about?
You've been spreading toxic lies about Arbor's involvement in Remy Darden's murder. We don't appreciate it.
Okay.
This issue is settled. Arbor wasn't involved. Your client was arrested for the murder.
And acquitted after a jury trial,
Jason interrupted.
There's a reason the police charged your client.
He did not want to provoke Chambers, but each time she spoke, he could feel the intensity of his protective instincts ratchet upwards. This ultra-rich person reinforced his belief that those with power lacked accountability and that normal people suffered as a result. It was the kind of injustice that had left Anton mangled on the cold street, framed for a crime by the police. When he looked at his clients these days, he often saw Anton's visage in their eyes. He saw Lady Justice hiding behind her blindness, not seeing the unfairness and imbalance in plain view.
There's also a reason why 12 of Tobias's peers found him not guilty. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and his involvement didn't make sense.
Jason sipped his champagne as Chambers glared at him.
Darden was not just murdered. He was executed.
I know what happened.
Chambers scowled.
Shot 3 times point blank. Professional. Double tap to the chest and a shot to the head.
Jason tapped his chest and his forehead.
Random opportunistic street robbery doesn't happen with that precision.
Chambers shook her head.
Your theories may have fooled a jury composed of common people, but they're far-fetched at best.
You're clearly an incredibly smart person, but your disdain for the jury and for their acquittal after a trial probably means you have no respect for the rule of law, or maybe it means you feel superior to the legal system. I've thought about this, M. Chambers. Why would Darden be executed on the night before Branch's release? The obvious answer is to shut him up. But who would want to do that? For argument's sake, let's say there were something wrong with Branch. As technical director of your organotech division, he would know about it. If that were true, his death would be convenient for Arbor.
There's nothing wrong with Branch,
Chambers snapped. She wagged her finger at Jason.
You're making serious allegations against us. You're insinuating Arbor was involved in executing Darden. It's slanderous. We won't tolerate it. Next step is to get our lawyers involved.
I'm just doing my job.
Your job?
Chambers scoffed.
You're a scumbag defense attorney. You lie through your teeth so criminals can run through the streets. What tangible contributions do you make to society?
Jason chuckled.
Like I've never heard that insult before. Looks like your money can't buy humor or a quick wit.
Chambers' cheeks reddened.
Were you just going to disparage my career or did you have something worthwhile to say?
We both know you don't have credible evidence about Darden's death that points anywhere close to Arbor. Stop spreading falsehoods and conspiracy theories.
I'll do what I need to do. I don't owe you anything.
Chambers frowned.
You have Branch, microdisc implants and cellbot injections, don't you?
Jason shrugged.
So?
It's okay.
Chambers nodded and sighed.
Everybody does. It's a product contributing to the evolution of humanity.
Chambers was attempting to broadcast a calm and confident demeanor.
Even though you hate me, you need what my company offers. See, Branch, it's my product and it's inside of you. Whether you like it or not, I am a part of you.
Jason cackled.
The hell you are.
He sipped his champagne. Chambers' top lip lifted into a slight snarl.
Arbor is so powerful that you, a hater, can't even resist getting Branch integrated into your body.
Jason rolled his eyes.
Get out of my face, all right? I'm going to advocate for my clients no matter what. If I have evidence Arbor was involved in Darden's murder, I'll talk about it to help clear my client's name. I don't care how amazingly powerful and wealthy you think you are.
He emphasized the word think to irritate Chambers.
You're just a human being made of meat and bones and blood, just like the rest of us. Just like my friend who dug up dirt on Arbor who was killed by an eye taxi.
Your friend got what she deserved,
Chambers hissed.
Do you know who you're talking to?
You may think you're amazing, but honestly, I don't care about you at all. Even when you say hateful things about my friend, someone you don't even know. Maybe she found something about Arbor you don't like and it irritates you.
Chambers' eyes widened slightly.
Arbor is the greatest company in history.
It's really not all that great.
Jason looked at his watch.
Anyway, I usually say have a good evening, but you can go fuck yourself.
He turned away. Chambers maneuvered in front of Jason, blocking his path. She leaned her face near his ear and stabbed his chest with her finger.
You're a nobody. I don't know how you were accepted into this elite club, but it doesn't matter. You're forgettable. You're a pixel in the metaverse. You're a solitary packet of data in a digital ocean. Nobody cares about you. Nobody will remember you. Whereas me, people will remember my contributions to the evolution of humanity.
Jason could smell her scent, a powerful and disorienting aroma of copper and fresh lumber.
You're delusional.
Jason started to leave. Her firm hand gripped his bicep tightly. He glanced at the finger squeezing his arm, then back at Chambers. She jerked him toward her body, causing the champagne to spill over the lip of the flute glass onto Jason's hand. He could feel Chambers' hot breath on his ear and neck as she spoke.
You better watch your back. Making an enemy out of a trillionaire CEO and owner of the most powerful tech company in the world, it's risky. You should think it over before someone gets hurt.
Are you threatening me?
I don't threaten. I plan.
Did you threaten Darden like this too, or just plan his murder?
They locked eyes. Chambers bared her teeth in a snarl as if she were growling, and fleetingly, Jason could see her tiger-esque ferocity. Then she dropped Jason's arm and stepped back.
Think about what I've said. If you stop throwing shade at my company, we'd greatly appreciate it. It might even save you some discomfort in the future.
Bright white teeth gleamed in her smile, and Jason could see the glint of ruthlessness behind her dark eyes as she walked away.
Am I in the crosshairs of a techno-trillionaire?
He shook his head.
Forget Chambers. What matters is meeting Rose.
Chapter 29. I'm on fire. Mac. None of the three investment presentations that night could distract Mac from his singular purpose: to gather intelligence for Esri so she could formulate a plan to steal Rose's diamond. When he arrived, he counted the security guards and doors. He failed to identify any security technology, like cameras or biometric locks, though he noted the giant metal vault door that separated the entry corridor from the reception hall. He also observed the doors discreetly inset in the walls. He knew one of those doors led to the kitchen because he had helped cater some events when the club had hired his father's company before his criminal charges. He remembered all the cameras, guards, manual locks, and the sally port in the kitchen wing.
It's not a practical way in, even if we got in that way. The vault-like door separating the kitchen from the club is auto-locked once Compass Rose takes the stage.
Even Easton's vague response about the club's UD security measures provided him no valuable information, except that bringing a UD into the club would cause all the UD's data to encrypt, and thus be rendered useless.
Without more information, Esri's going to be furious. I need more.
One thing happened, however, that piqued his curiosity. Earlier in the evening, Mac had witnessed Easton and the club security guards escort red-faced Eric Romstaller out of the front door.
I wonder what happened with Romstaller,
he thought.
Did he do something to get kicked out of the club?
Mac was unsure if it was useful information for Esri. Indeed, he was afraid that his efforts to gather intelligence were woefully inadequate to keep him in her good graces.
If you fuck this up, Esri will probably torture you and cut out your eyes.
As the presentations ended and the holographic displays disappeared, the lights dimmed and Song's vaguely female voice filled the auditorium with the darkness.
Please welcome Compass Rose,
Song purred. The red velvet curtain rose to reveal the musician's silhouettes, like cardboard cutouts backlit by a red light. A quiet and slow guitar plucked a muted arpeggiated chord, while the drummer tapped a soft hi-hat beat. The bass droned deep rhythmic tones that resonated with the guitar. Rose danced back and forth in a slow sway at the stage's front. The audience stared up at her, who appeared as a human-shaped void of light, dancing and singing against the red. Even Mac, hyper-focused on gathering information for Esri, became entranced by Rose's voice and her duet with the guitar. As the melodic longing of the Springsteen song reached its auditory vanishing point, the trance over the audience lifted like a morning fog in the sun, and the metallic hum of the last guitar chord reverberated into non-existence. The audience applauded, and Rose and the band bowed to the spectators.
This club is amazing,
Mac thought, as he likewise launched from his chair clapping with zeal. He realized that he loved the Pyramid Club. It earned him money hand over fist. It brought together society's elite and supplied them a secure respite from the scrutiny of the hoi polloi. It provided entertainment so unique its patrons could selfishly keep for themselves. Then a somber thought surfaced in Mac's mind.
Survival overrides love. I must betray and destroy this place, or I won't survive.
Chapter 30. Nobody Knows. Mac. Mac was reclining in his armchair in sweatpants, toying with his UD. Suddenly, his screen went dark. It ceased responding to his branch commands or his touch. Mac lifted it up, crinkled his nose, and squinted, trying to determine the problem. 10 seconds later, white block letters flashed onto the display. You have been invited. Where? Disco Ardent, Dumbo, Brooklyn. When? Tonight, March 23rd, 2040. Doors open at 23 hours. Status, VIP list.
Ezra,
Mac thought.
It's not an invitation, it's a demand.
After reviewing the message, more text appeared.
You will not be admitted into my club with those ratty gray sweats that you have on, so get yourself together.
Every message she had ever sent him included a demonstration of her dominion over his life. She could access his UD and manipulate his digital world whenever she pleased. He imagined her seated before an enormous computer screen watching live footage of him as he lounged in his armchair, eyes widening as he realized she was monitoring him. The thought made his stomach twist. He stood up, left his UD on the coffee table, and paced in his living room.
Damn, this means I have to cancel dinner with Dad.
They had planned to dine together at 9 o'clock that evening at one of the family restaurants in Midtown. Gio would be disappointed, but the alternative was facing the whims of Ezri's Olympian caprice, which could include infliction of pain. After it sat disabled for 5 total minutes, control of the UD returned to Mac. He activated his thought lock code. Pepper, yellow 7, stone, Italy, blue circle, bear. And his branch functioned once again. He mentally drafted a message to his father using branch.
Hey, Dad. I'm sorry, but I can't make it tonight for dinner at Intero. Something came up.
A few minutes later, Gio's response popped up on Mac's UD.
I'm dismayed to hear that you won't be joining me. It's imperative that we speak soon about when you're going to take over the restaurants.
It was late afternoon, no doubt that his father would soon be getting ready for dinner, donning one of his luxurious double-breasted suits and preparing his hair.
Let's reschedule for a night next week. I'm sorry, Dad.
His guilt felt heavy, like cannonballs in his chest. How could Mac wear the family crown if he could not even make it to dinner? Would he be worthy of the role after he betrayed the Pyramid Club, the institution that helped bring wealth to his family, protected his father during dark days, and helped him pay for Jason to beat his charges? He remembered his invitation to the Pyramid Club, the delivery of the Song Program LD, the first investment presentations for which he was a participant, the first Compass Rose performance he watched. His greatest achievement had been membership to the club for his own accomplishments, and he was proud to join his father there. Years ago, Gio had named him Chief Operating Officer of the Mason Family Company, directing the service of their most opulent and renowned restaurants. Specifically, Mac had taken charge of the Manhattan-based luxury restaurant group. Seated in the office of their flagship, a traditional French-style restaurant called Joie de Vivre, he worked all day and night. He balanced the books, planned menus and promotions with the executive chef, and orchestrated the operations for all the group's restaurants. He reminisced of his past successes as he dragged himself into his bedroom to change. He paused in the hallway when he glimpsed the framed New York Magazine cover featuring himself. He posed in a fine suit with his arms crossed next to a colorful platter of food.
I had excelled.
Stellar reviews spread across the socials like wildfire. Revenues skyrocketed. Celebrities battled to get on the wait list. Dining at Joie de Vivre became a feather in the cap for culinary journalists and self-proclaimed socials foodie influencers. After 2 years of incrementally elevating the Mason restaurant empire, New York Magazine published a cover story on Mac. As the feature, he had posed on the cover. He had finally achieved the success his father hoped for him. It was at this peak in his success that the Pyramid Club invited him to follow in his father's footsteps and become a member. He stared at the magazine cover.
I want that life back. I want to show my dad that I'm worthy of his admiration.
Negative memories accompanied the positive ones. His ongoing successes cost him. Sleep deprivation had taken its toll. Just as quickly as he rose to prominence and crested, he plummeted to his nadir, marked by his gun and drug charges. The lifestyle of a successful restaurateur had been difficult to sustain. The demanding hours required intense and undiminishing vitality. When caffeine's effectiveness began to wane, Mac had developed a fondness for cocaine. He had frequented clubs in Deep Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan, bringing copious amounts of drugs with him to parties that lasted until sunrise, and dropping thousands of dollars on vodka and champagne for friends whose allegiances bounced between his bottles and his baggies. As his habits intensified, he started purchasing large quantities on par with mid-level traffickers. He started making orders too big to be filled by his street dealer, so his dealer's suppliers took notice and Mac earned a distributor's discount. It turned out that his cocaine supply chain was under Esri's control. He examined his face in the New York magazine cover. With his beautiful Italian suit and confident posture, he looked powerful. He shook his head and sighed, trudging toward his bedroom closet. The large mirror in his closet showed him an image that was starkly different from the accomplished Mac on the magazine cover. He had dark bags under his eyes, wrinkled sweatpants, and an undershirt with darkened armpit stains. His skin sagged off his face like a melted rubber mask. His complexion was the color of moldy white wall paint, and his cheeks were sunken. He looked like a junkie, even though he had gotten sober after his criminal charges with the support of his father and encouragement from Jason.
Drugs destroyed my life and chipped away at my soul. Now I'm disgraced and beholden to a vicious criminal dealer.
His cocaine habit had taken him over and started his precipitous drop to the bottom. His productivity for the restaurant group suffered. Paranoia consumed him. He became convinced he was being followed by street gangs. He bought an unlicensed gun from a guy in an alley in Queens referred by Esri. When the success of the restaurants deteriorated, Gio told Mac to take a leave of absence. He remembered his father's words.
I love you, Mac, but this isn't you,
Gio had said.
Your lifestyle is going to kill you and tarnish the family name. Your mother would be heartbroken at how you've turned out. Take a break and address your issues. You can come back when you're clean and sober.
The words had been a sweeping spear stroke to Mac's gut, and the shame burned hot in his thorax.
I wish I had listened, Dad.
Without the money from the restaurants, Mac offered to do a job for Esri to earn enough cash for a big bag of cocaine. When he had deleted the secret software from his Tesla before transferring it to the foreign buyers, he had picked up criminal charges and landed in Esri's pocket.
I'm going to do whatever it takes to dig myself out of this hole.
He felt shame for the future damage he would likely cause to his father's legacy and guilt for how he would betray the Pyramid Club to protect himself from Esri. He hoped Esri would release him when he obtained the diamond for her, as she had promised. He would have to live with his betrayal, but at least he would be alive. Chapter 31. Butterfly Caught. Mac. The AI taxi was waiting outside of Mac's building with eternal patience when he emerged from the front door. He jogged to it, his long wool coat flapping behind him in the cold wind. He tapped his UD to the rider panel on the rear passenger's side door and stepped into the back seat of the vehicle, his heart racing from an anxious anticipation about what might happen at Esri's establishment. Disco Ardent was a warehouse in the Dumbo neighborhood in Brooklyn, close to the river. The nondescript warehouse entrance lacked any identifiers showing that it was a nightclub, except for its simplistic neon gold sign depicting the outline of an apple. Mac knew it to be a temple of hedonism, a bacchanal of epic proportions boasting copious high-powered alcohol and energy drink cocktails, a not-so-underground drug scene with any pill, herb, or powder conceivable, and sweaty masses sliding and grinding on each other's bodies. Casting conservative norms of social distancing aside, in an intimate, vastly overlapping personal space, Venn diagram. In other circumstances, Mac would relish the drugs and the sex, But just as the thought crossed his mind, he reminded himself that it was his playboy recklessness that led him to be in his current disadvantageous position under Ezri's thumb. The AI taxi pulled in front of Disco Ardent. Mac disembarked from the AI taxi, shut the door behind him, and proceeded into what appeared to be a truck bay of a ramshackle warehouse. A line of clubgoers decked in colorful and revealing apparel wrapped around the perimeter of the concrete truck bay. One end of the snaking line terminating near a door guarded by large men and women, the other ending near where the garage doors met the street. The Golden Apple sign appeared to hover next to the door on the landing, marking the entrance to where the crowd sought eagerly to enter.
Get your UDs out for a digital security scan.
A security guard stationed at the door bellowed, face illuminated by the golden yellow hue of the apple. Another guard stood at the front of the line and waved a baton over each entrance UD, then beckoning them through with a meaty hand. Trying to appear cool and collected, Mac sauntered across the truck bay, climbed the stairs, and stood in front of the door. The guard barking instructions at the crowd nodded at Mac, giving tacit permission to enter. He was not subjected to the same security screening as the other patrons. The enormous dark space pulsed with streaks and tubes of bright-colored lights, which intersected and mingled. The walls, painted black, enhanced the feeling of being removed from the context of everyday life, like a giant Faraday cage blocking the unrelenting signals of society from entering. Normally, such an environment would excite Mac, but the thought of meeting with Ezri again made him feel an overwhelming loss of control over his life. He was beholden to her until she obtained Rose's diamond. People swarmed the club's corner bar. Bartenders grabbed bottles of liquor from the underlit tiered shelves lining the walls. They exchanged loud words across the bar with the people queued four deep seeking alcohol, their social lubrication and liquid pluck. Pulse trance music thumped, resonating in the walls, the floors, and Mac's ears. Gyrating people oozed with lust as the languid bodies writhed rhythmically together, but Mac tried to switch off his desire to dance, drink, roll, snort, or pop. He shook his head, ridding his mind of the voice that often swayed his decision-making processes toward self-indulgence. He spotted the VIP area on a raised platform across the dance floor, cordoned off by velvet ropes.
"That's where she'll be,"
he thought. He pushed through the fluid of dancing humans to get to the other side. A security guard stood statue still as Mac walked warily past him into the VIP area.
"No sign of Ezri."
A tall, muscular woman approached and beckoned to him with a hand gesture, so he followed her as she walked with purpose toward the back. She appeared to thrust her arm into what he thought was a solid surface, defying the tenets of physics. But then Mac realized that the stiff black curtain covering the doorway was virtually indistinguishable from the wall around it, until the guard pushed it aside. Mac's heartbeat spiked when he realized he was leaving the public area of the venue.
"Here we go."
The guard escorted him down a darkly lit hallway lined by offices that Mac figured were vestiges of the warehouse's original industrial purpose. The offices appeared to have been transformed into private rooms, and he did not know what to expect. The guard walked up to an office at the end of the hallway and rapped on the door. Mac heard an indiscernible loud response. The guard nodded at Mac, grabbing the door handle, opening the door ajar, and stepping away from the entrance.
"Thanks,"
he said loudly over the music and pushed the door open. What Mac saw in the room startled and confused him at first. He recoiled and turned his head away.
"What the fuck?"
There were three intermingled people moaning. He identified Ezri, back arched against a red leather couch, chin tilted back, and eyes closed in ecstasy. Between her spread legs, a naked man, rear end in the air, knelt before Ezri's body, his face nestled between Ezri's thighs, head slowly moving. Next to Ezri was another woman, who lay down the length of the couch, propping herself up on her triceps. Her face pointed down her naked body at Ezri, eyes closed as she held her large breasts. Ezri's hand moved slowly, fingers reaching inside the woman's body. The scene shocked Mac into backpedaling into the hallway.
Mac!
Esri yelled,
"Get the fuck in here!"
Mac obeyed, walking into the corner and crossing his arms in a protective self-hug. He watched as Esri opened her eyes, which blazed a fiery gold, and retracted her fingers from the woman's crotch without tenderness, then grabbed the sides of the man's face and pulled him up. The woman sat up and looked at Mac as the man stood. Mac could see the man's cock standing at attention as he turned around, although Mac tried not to look.
"Out!"
Esri commanded, loudly and firmly. Her two concubines grabbed clothing strewn across the room and started to dress. The woman managed to put on her bra, and the man had pulled some boxer briefs over his erection.
"For fuck's sake!"
Esri said, exasperated.
"Get the fuck out! Like fucking now!"
The woman and man exchanged glances, balled up their clothes, and hurried out of the room. Max stood in the corner, mouth agape. Esri acted how she felt like acting, did what she wanted to do, fucked who she wanted to fuck, dismissed who she wanted to dismiss. Mac expected this caprice extended to killing whomever she wanted to kill. Esri sat nonchalantly on the couch, as if it were a business cocktail party. She grabbed a clear drink from the end table and sipped it casually. A slate device of some kind lay dormant like a graphite shingle next to one bottle of Belvedere vodka and two large bottles of Moët and Chandon champagne.
"Come sit,"
Esri demanded, tapping the cushion next to her. He walked warily over to the couch, uncomfortable because she was not wearing any pants or undergarments. He felt awkward and scared, but that could not stop his eyes from drifting to her star-shaped pubic hair or glancing at her vagina, which she took no care to cover. He did not want to become the modern-day Actaeon, who was turned into a buck and hunted by Artemis after peeking at her bathing in a spring.
"You went to the Pyramid Club. Did you discover anything to help me acquire this supposedly massive diamond?"
Mac took a deep breath.
"I haven't found any other entrances besides the front door and the kitchen, but I've studied the general layout. The common areas of the club are flanked by a hallway. There are doors to backstage, but the owner seems to be the only one with access to whatever's back there. The club also has a kitchen, but it's a dead end."
"Not good enough, Mac."
Esri wagged a finger at him. Mac flushed.
"The singer, Rose, wore the diamond again at the most recent performance."
"Give me more!"
Esri barked. She stared at him, golden irises seemingly spinning around her pupils like the hub of a shimmering wheel.
"The place is more locked down than I knew,"
Mac said.
"There were two security guards when I arrived, greeting people as they walked through the entry hallway, and they had guns, handguns. I didn't notice any cameras in the hallway or the common areas, no biometric locks or anything like that, just a giant metal door."
Just then, Mac noticed that in the space on the red couch between Esri's legs sat an enormous chrome pistol. Mac looked at the gun, then at Esri, who was grinning.
"I'm bored with your attempts to buy my mercy,"
Esri sighed.
"You're an uptight prude. You mess up all the time. I would get a lot more pleasure making modern art on the wall using your face as the brush and brains as the paint."
She picked up the pistol, which was so big it made her look like a child. She tossed the gun between her hands, catching the handle each time.
"If you were interesting or fun, or if you could fuck, I could tolerate your whining."
She pointed the gun at him.
"Wait, I have more for you."
Mac lifted his arms defensively. She looked at him and raised an eyebrow.
"Yeah, I do. A member of the Pyramid Club was kicked out that night. That's a huge deal. No one noticed but me."
"And?"
Esri sneered.
"Eric Romstoller. He's a big financier and a total asshole."
"I've heard of him. Get to the point."
"I saw him go to the club's back hallway. He came back like 20 or 30 minutes later. His hair was messed up and his face was red, like he had been in a fight. I thought it was strange, so I watched him."
Mac looked at Esri to gauge her reaction.
"He got kicked out."
He cleared his throat out of nervousness. Esri lowered the gun but continued to stare wide-eyed at Mac. He continued.
"Easton went in, and after a few minutes, he and Romstoller walked out toward the entrance of the club with two armed security guards behind him."
"So you want to see why this fucker Romstoller got thrown out?"
"Yes, maybe we can use it as leverage."
Mac exhaled,
glad that she understood his angle.
But what happened also gave me insight into the security of the place.
The music throbbed cyclically in his ears and head.
Now you're cooking,
said Esri.
Keep going.
I also learned what happens to our UDs in the club. The terms of service say we cannot bring them in, but there's more to it. Easton told me that the UD would cease functioning. He even suggested that club security could detect a UD in the building, and it could be damaged simply by being on the premises.
Mac looked at Esri, who seemed focused on what Mac was saying.
Personally, I'm not super familiar with security tech, but I've never heard of anything commercially available that could disable a UD like that. Maybe he was bluffing.
No,
Esri said definitively.
It's not a bluff.
She shot off the couch, causing Mac to flinch, then pulled on black jeans that lay in a heap. Mac eyed the large pistol which remained on the couch.
I have been researching this Pyramid Club place.
She turned around and faced Mac, now partially clothed.
I followed you there the last time you went.
Mac blinked. It did not surprise him.
I discovered something fascinating. There are yttrium terracotta optic superconductors and ACS diamond fiber cables that connect whatever servers are in there to the interweb.
She paused and grabbed her glasses, which had been on a table.
The energy supply rivals that of a server farm that takes up 200 times more space, but it's also scaled more efficiently. My guess is that someone is running quantum computing infrastructure to support AI in there. The security system you described must be linked to this network somehow. Whatever infrastructure housed within may be more valuable than that diamond you keep blabbing about.
She looked up at Mac.
I still want it, though. I bet I'd look positively glamorous in it.
She batted her eyes and framed her face in her hands in a parody of cuteness. She strutted up to Mac, who recoiled, and patted him on the head like a dog.
Good boy. You're going to keep working on getting me that diamond. But now, you're also going to help me infiltrate the Pyramid Club network.
How am I going to do that?
Mac asked.
Don't you worry about how.
She lightly slapped him on the cheek.
First, just try and gather information from this Romstaller character. Get the angle on him.
I don't know how or where to find him.
That is information I can get you easily,
Esri responded as she walked toward the door. She turned around and looked at Mac. Esri's mouth spread into the mischievous smile Mac had learned to hate and fear.
For now, just learn to accept my gifts and make sure to dress nicely for your meeting with Romstaller, as well as the next Pyramid Club event.
What does she mean, learn to accept gifts?
He thought. Her erratic behavior made no sense to him, and he could not figure out why she would give him gifts when she viewed him as a disposable minion.
I don't understand.
You'll see.
She strode out of the room and yelled something sounding vaguely like names down the hallway. When she spun around, she was smiling. It made Mac think of a crescent of white square pixels.
Maybe someone can suck the fun right out of you,
she said.
Behold my first gift?
She acted like she was questioning whether it was the appropriate word. She looked down the hall, then looked back at Mac.
Gifts.
Esri stepped out of the room, but held the door open. The first man through the door wore jeans and a white graphic t-shirt. The second man wore black pants and a baby blue V-neck shirt with rips across the chest, meant to evoke the idea that a tiger had raked the shirt with its claws. Esri slapped the rear end of each of the men as they ran past. The first woman through the door wore a crop top that seemed to be pulled up higher than it should have been by her breasts, accompanying baggy jeans that hugged the underside of her rear. The last woman, slender and pale, had on a short cocktail dress with a plunging neckline revealing her collarbones. Before this woman could enter, Esri grabbed the girl's throat with her hand and purred. The woman yelped, then smiled as she looked at Esri. The two started to kiss, their tongues visibly intertwined from Mac's vantage point. He squirmed, then retreated as far as he could into the couch.
What the fuck is going on?
Mac said, starting to push himself out off the couch. Before the words had left his mouth, Esri jerked her head away from the kiss.
Hey!
She said aggressively, still holding the woman's throat with one hand. The enormous pistol had reappeared in her hand, and now she was pointing it at Mac.
You will accept my gifts, or I will be offended.
She emphasized the word offended.
I didn't mean...
Max stammered.
You didn't mean to what? To offend me?
Ezri let out a single loud cackle.
They are going to fuck the prude right out of you if it's the last thing you do,
Ezri declared.
It should be entertaining.
She slammed her hand on the end table. A stack of pills and vials with white powder remained after she removed her hand.
Have fun, boys and girls,
Ezri said.
I have work to do, but Mac...
She paused.
I'll be watching.
She pointed to a tiny camera in the corner where the ceiling met the wall, then left. He looked at the camera. Its little golden light blinked, which made him think of Ezri watching him with her golden eyes. The skinny girl who had been kissing Ezri strutted over to Mac and mounted him. She started grinding her hips on Mac's, leaning in to kiss him. Still disoriented, he looked around at the scene. The man who wore a blue shirt had discarded it to the floor already and had grabbed a pill and vial of the powder. He leaned over to Mac and ran his pointer finger around Mac's lips, pushing the pill gently into Mac's mouth. Meanwhile, the girl straddling Mac's hips kissed his neck, ripping the shirt open from the top to the bottom. Next thing Mac knew, a tilted bottle of Moët and Chandon hovered over his mouth, and he accepted a trickle of the effervescent gold and swallowed the pill. The man in the white t-shirt and the woman with the crop top were entangled with each other on the floor. The woman shed her shirt, exposing her silicone chest. She sat on the floor with her back against the couch, her shoulder next to Mac's knee, her hands raised over her head, holding onto the couch. The man with the white tee tapped a line of the white powder onto the rise of her bosom with one hand, and with the other hand, had reached up behind the woman on Mac's lap. Mac could not see what the man's hands did, but he felt a gentle squeeze on his package, and then he felt another hand move to his belt, unbuckle it, and yank one leg of his pants off, followed by the other. He saw the man press his nose against the woman's breast, inhaling the powder through his nostril.
What's happening right now?
Mac had sworn to himself to clean up his act since the day Jason Sola helped him beat his case. He had been headed down the road of legitimacy. He would inherit the family business empire. He was sober. He had stopped carrying a gun. He had stopped doing drugs. He was clean. He was clean. He relinquished his anxiety.
I don't have a choice, and I'm probably going to die soon.
He had been leaning back into the pillows of the couch, but he suddenly sat up straight, edging to the front of the couch while maneuvering the woman's legs around the bottom of his back. He swiped a vial from the table, unscrewed its cap, and tapped a tiny white anthill into the trough between the tendons of his thumb and snorted the powder. Suddenly, it felt like someone turned on jets in his bloodstream. The familiar feeling of the cocaine ripping through his system, the servitude to Ezri, and the wonderful carnal feeling of sex altogether signaled to him there was no turning back to the clean path. She had compromising footage of him now, but he did not care. He was ready to get dirty. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials at Bantam Drexler or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.